Welcome to the Legal Nurse Podcast, where you'll get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside the legal nurse consulting business. They'll share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with over 30 years' experience. So join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's your host, Pat Iyer.
Hi, this is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. We have a show every week in which we bring in experts to talk about various aspects of medicine, legal nurse consulting, running a legal nurse consulting business. And one of the subjects that has long fascinated me has been the forensic aspects of medicine. I'm the person who likes to read about serial killers, who loves to solve problems, and find forensic psychology fascinating in terms of how people react and what they do. So I brought with me on the show today Ken Manges, who specializes in the field of psychological and vocational evaluations, treatments, and consultations. He testifies as an expert witness. He's a certified forensic psychologist and a vocational expert, and the president and CEO of Ken Manges and Associates. He's qualified and has testified in federal, military, and state courts, and has expertise in both psychological and vocational testing and interpretation. Ken, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Pat. I appreciate the invitation and the opportunity to share my interest with you.
Tell us about how you got started in this field.
Well, it's an interesting story. We're talking about 51 years ago, I was a soldier in Vietnam. And as a soldier, we were not infrequently called out to protect various locations. And at that particular time, I was stationed in Saigon, Tan Zanut, where General Westmoreland was stationed as well. We were told to go to sleep with our boots on. We could untie them, but we couldn't take them off because we were anticipating being called out, which we were, in the middle of the night. And so about 3 a.m., we were called out to protect the soccer field because Bob Hope was going to be there the next day. I rest assured the soccer field survived. The next morning, I went to chow, and the sergeant comes up to me and he says, "Manges, after chow, I want you to go over and I want you to see those Viet Cong who tried to kill us in the middle of the night." I said, "Sarge, I've seen dead people before, but no thanks." He said, "Manges, did you think that was a request?" And I said, "Yes, Sarge." So I went over to see the misshapen bodies of the people who tried to overrun our camp the night before. And although I was struck by the dismemberment and the blood and the guts, what really shocked me was that I recognized three of those men. And the reason I recognized them were they were our barbers. And that freaked me out. And I was trying to appreciate and understand what made them flip from wanting to cut our hair during the day to wanting to cut our throats at night. Before that time, it was your average G.I. Joe. But after that, I had a mission. I wanted to figure out what would make them change, what would have them thinking that they wanted to kill the people whom they had a close relationship with. And because of that, I wanted to figure out how to best understand that, and I became a forensic.
So you came back from the war. I assume that you became a psychologist and then specialized in forensic psychology?
I entered college. I wasn't a college student until after the war, a GI Bill. Mm-hmm. And then I said, psychology. I finished an undergraduate degree, and I said, "Is that all there is?" When I finished the master's, I said, "Is that all there is?" I finished a PhD, and I said, is that all there is? I was called to do forensic evaluations and testify a few times. And the first time, I was sliced and diced. It was not a comfortable situation. And I said, I don't know that I want to go through this again. But I was enticed, and I tried it again, and nope, no way. And then I tried it one more time, and I realized that at that point that the attorneys really didn't have an appreciation of how to use my skills. And I didn't know that at the time, but I realized that after getting my certification from the University of Virginia in 1984 in forensic psychology, because that was after my PhD. And I then could appreciate and understand what the federal rules were, what the state rules were, how to testify, how to do evaluations that would withhold that I could support during the scrutiny of cross-examination, depositions, discovery, and direct testimony. And so I used that skill from school and to pursue a more forensic-oriented practice. My first practice in that area was in clinical work, where I was doing clinical therapy, which I still do. I still practice. As a matter of fact, in order to testify as a forensic expert, as a psychologist, you must maintain a clinical practice, which I do. And then I developed my forensic practice to do evaluations, both criminal as well as civil.
What separates clinical psychology from forensic psychology?
Good question. And it's not uncommon that I am asked to review cases in which a clinician has offered an opinion, a causal opinion between the plaintiff's condition and what it is that they are asserting as damages in a legal case. It turns out that if you're a clinician, you have an advocacy role for your clients. And as a forensic, you're not. You're Switzerland. You are neutral. The difference between being a clinician and a forensic is that a clinician is offering treatment, and a forensic is offering causative evaluations and opinions with regards to what the circumstances are that the individual is experiencing that may have led them to the symptoms that they're talking about. So a clinician cannot testify as an expert. They can be a fact witness. And a forensic is not a clinician doing treatment. He or she is doing evaluations from a neutral position.
Then if I understand what you're saying, in the example of a person who is accused of committing a murder, and the question is, what was the state of mind of that person at the time of the crime? The clinician would not be qualified to offer an opinion, but the forensic psychologist would be. Is that right?
The clinician could offer a fact opinion saying that this individual suffers from delusions, they suffer from paranoia, they suffer from other circumstances which they are treating. The forensic can say that those conditions are the cause of their incompetency.
Okay. How did you learn those pieces that you mentioned earlier of the federal rules, the state rules, how to present testimony? Were you self-taught? Did you go through a course? Was it the School of Hard Knocks?
All of the above. Okay. There are courses that are offered for expert witnesses. There are seminars that I myself present. And so as a teacher, you may know that if you're going to know a topic very well, your students will grill you, so you must know it very well. And as a matter of fact, it's not uncommon for me to present to other experts about the areas that I am an expert in. In August, I'm scheduled to go, April, I'm scheduled to go to Tucson to present to the American Board of Vocational Experts on Federal Rule 35. And Federal Rule 35 allows opposing counsel to sit in on or videotape the interview that the expert does. And recently I had a series of them in which there were two, which one videotaped me, one audiotaped me, two different cases. And the third one, the opposing counsel demanded to sit in on the evaluation. And it was very disruptive. So I can appreciate what, in that case, Federal Rule 35 is in terms of the right for the plaintiff's counsel or opposing counsel to sit in or to video or audio tape the expert witness's evaluation. And so I always ask, what is the statute that the parameters of the statute that I am being asked to offer my opinion about? Have there been any, what's opposing counsel's name? What's opposing counsel's witnesses' names to see if I have any conflict, but also to see if there are any elements of that particular case that go beyond the bounds of customary rules and statutes that I'm familiar with. Because I testify all over the United States, and there are some circumstances that are I'm not familiar with, because they haven't occurred with me in certain instances. There's a thing in military courts where there's ex parte communication between the expert and opposing counsel. That I was very unfamiliar with. So they could invite me in without the plaintiff or the defendant's representation there. And it's more like an informal deposition. And that's very unusual for me. But it's allowed in military courts. So I always ask beforehand, what am I facing?
And tell me, you also have this combination, which I don't think is common, of being involved in clinical and forensic psychology and also in vocational expertise. How did you combine those two pieces?
Well, I have always been interested, because of my degrees, in both. My PhD is in counseling and personnel services. And I started doing treatment, and I started working with children, and then I worked with adults. And in working with adults, my expertise in terms of the counseling and personnel services was they were asking of me to do evaluations, either self-referred or other referred agencies, about the vocational skills and choices that people are making because of either being let go from a job that they had for many years or wanting to make transitions to new work. So when it is that I became involved in forensic work, I was asked, can you evaluate this person's damages from a vocational perspective? And I said, yeah, because I have that background. I hadn't pursued that. I had pursued the psychological side. But I said, yeah, I can pursue that. And I then reached out to the community at large, and I said, where can I get the competency training in terms of testifying as a vocational expert? And the only federally recognized association in that area is the American Board of Vocational Experts. So I said, oh, that's a good group to join. So in 1987, I joined that group. And in 2000, I climbed up the ladder, the administrative ladder. And in 2000, I was the president of the American Board of Vocational Experts. Mm-hmm. And the law caught up with that, interestingly, because as you are probably familiar, the pain and suffering, there are caps on pain and suffering for damages in civil matters, and usually they're capped at about $250,000. But there are no such caps in vocational areas. And many of the communities in which I testify are very conservative. And so the damages that a plaintiff's counsel may be able to obtain in a matter in which the person has been terribly injured, if they only pursue pain and suffering, there is a cap in which what they might be able to return in terms of compensation. So I am called upon to do both of those things, both the vocational side and the psychological trauma side. And in some cases, I can certainly tell stories, as most of your listeners might also be able to do. I have multiple cases in which there are multiple plaintiffs in which I'm doing one or the other or both.
Well, that's an interesting point, Ken, because the states that have caps, and for the benefit of our listeners, not all states in the United States have caps on pain and suffering. The attorneys are focused on what are the damages. Can there be vocational loss? Is there loss of consortium? Are there other types of losses, medical bills, that influence whether a case is even attractive for a plaintiff attorney to file? And I know that you've been involved in evaluating losses of a variety of types of cases. What do you do, or have you encountered the situation of a person who's never worked, such as a child? How do you evaluate the losses when that person is catastrophically injured?
Let me break into the discussion at this point to share a resource with you that I know is vital to expert witnesses. Many experts are anxious about testifying. I saw this so frequently that I brought in two experienced expert witnesses to provide a one-hour training called Take the Terror Out of Testifying. Does the idea of testifying at a deposition or trial give you the butterflies? Many legal nurse consultants fear giving deposition or trial testimony. In this one-hour training, these two experienced nursing experts share lessons learned from the hot seat. They show you effective ways to deliver testimony while avoiding common pitfalls. They explain successful alternative strategies for handling cross-examination, including how to recognize and counter common legal maneuvering, give you a greater confidence about testifying, and help you keep from blurting out something that you shouldn't. And they show you how to effectively present your CV to prevent mischaracterization of your experience and accomplishments. Get this training at this link, http://lnc.tips/terror, and use the code LISTENED to get a 25% discount. The link is http://lnc.tips/terror. Now let's return to the show.
Well, it's not an uncommon phenomenon in which, you know, with catastrophic injuries where the person has died as a consequence of the injuries, as an adult, you may have a track record. You may have a work history that you can use to project had they survived using the forensic journals of economics. You can project how many average work life years they would have remaining had they not been killed. But in a pediatric case where the person, the child, has never worked, you are not relying upon, obviously, their work history, but you are looking at, and I have probably three active cases in that regard, so I'm fairly up to date in terms of what I look for and what you look at. You look at what the graduation rate is for the community in which they live in terms of high school. You look at if you have any academic records to determine whether or not they have intellect to complete high school and to go on to other levels of higher education. You look at what the parents have done in terms of their own education. You look at the parents, what they have done in terms of their own job-seeking skills. And so then you look, you craft a profile within a reasonable degree of certainty, what the likelihood is of a person in that home with those parents in that school system will or would have reasonably, within a scientific certainty, obtained should they have not been harmed or should they have not been injured the way they have been. The more difficult things certainly are those when you have disfigurement, post-traumatic stress disorder, and the number of digits or appendages that they still may be left with, because then you look at other nuances within the world of work and how those restrictions would play themselves out. And I do that in both catastrophic injuries where there are disfigurement, there's burning, there is loss of limb, also sexual molestation that happens as well. And then if I'm asked to testify for plaintiff and they ask me, what do we have going forward in terms of their quality of life? I talk about the possibility or likelihood within a reasonable degree of certainty, what milestones at which they might be re-traumatized. And it might be when they're going through puberty, it might be when they're graduating school, it might be when they're getting married, in which their injuries come into play in terms of both employment as well as quality of life.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about a couple of cases that I worked on involving children who were spinal cord injured in motor vehicle accidents because they weren't restrained properly. And all of the implications of that type of injury, one child was 2, another child was 10. The cases that I'm thinking of, the vocational impact, the medical impact, the body image impact, they're just phenomenal damages when you have that type of a situation for a child.
Sure, because what happens is the self-esteem is, from a plaintiff's perspective, the self-esteem is a part of, they are now perceive themselves as impaired, as disabled. And injured parties, and some identify themselves as being victims. And so that projects itself forward in terms of how they would then greet the world and how they would be in terms of competition and entering into school and peer relationships. All of those things are things that I consider and look at. And certainly it's not uncommon for defense counsel to call me and not to testify, but to look at whether or not the assertions by plaintiffs' experts are overreaching, or are consistent with the literature, or are inconsistent with the literature, and how that plays into it. How that expert from plaintiff's position is not being straightforward in terms of their assertions. And so whenever I look at a case, whenever I'm asked to be involved in a case, I look at it as though from both sides, because I fully expect that I'll be cross-examined about whatever it is that I opine about. That comes with the territory. But if I don't consider that opposing counsel's expert's position, then I've done a disservice to my client. And my client is the attorney. My client is not the injured individual. I do a disservice to my client because I'm not prepared for those cross-examination questions, the scrutiny of the basis for my opinions.
And attorneys can be very persuasive in trying to sell their theory of the case and having their experts testify the way that would be most helpful to the attorney. I remember several discussions I had with attorneys over the years emphasizing that my role was to let them know about the strengths and weaknesses of their case so that they wouldn't be surprised by their adversary in the courtroom. And I would imagine you have had similar discussions with attorneys.
Oh, many times. I often ask, you know, has the question come up about loss of consortium, quality of life? Is there an opinion with regards to long-term consequences in terms of employability? And because they'll call me in from a psychological standpoint, and I say, that's fine, and I can share with you what some of the challenges are in this matter. And does opposing counsel have a vocational expert? Are you pursuing that? So I ask them those questions as well.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever had your opinions challenged with a Daubert ruling?
On several occasions, opposing counsel has brought in their laptops, have imposed upon the judge to remove the jury so that they have the opportunity to voir dire me. They will then take my, they have taken my website, projected it onto a 20 by 40 foot wall, and examined me on every word that I have in my homepage. And that's happened several times. I have had opposing counsel come up to me while I'm on the witness stand and to slam down in front of me depositions that they have had printed out, and they had my name on them, and they say, you testified about these cases, didn't you? And that this person was at fault and that person was at fault. I said, yes, that's my name, but I didn't identify whose fault it was. That's not my role. My role is to talk about damages. And so the answer to your question is yes, I've had Daubert challenges, and I believe that I have been genuine in my presentation and have relied upon the scientific evidence, and I have never not been able to testify because of a Daubert challenge.
Mm-hmm. And just to wrap this up, when you testify, what are some of the obstacles that you have faced in addition to the Daubert challenge?
It's not uncommon for me to be mindful of what the limitations are for my testimony. I have to recognize that although I have multiple areas of specialty, we didn't go into the fact that I'm a diplomate in the, as a forensic expert, as a disabilities expert, as an expert in pain management, as an expert in testing and measures. So all of those come into play. Mm-hmm. And it's not uncommon for a opposing counsel to want to say, well, doctor, you have this degree, you have this certification, you have this diplomate. Why is it that you didn't evaluate that? And I'm locked into what the opposing, what the referring counsel asked me to evaluate. I said, I wasn't asked to offer an opinion about that. Mm-hmm. So that's a challenge to me. And then they'll say, here's a hypothetical for you, doctor. What if, and then they'll give me a series of statements. And I have to share that that's an interesting hypothetical, but is it in context? I don't know what was said before that, what question led up to that, whether or not that is the specific a statement that the person was responding to. And then they'll show me a document which I had not seen, because counsel who was making the referral didn't think that it was important that I see that. For whatever reason, they said, hey, it's a medical record. It doesn't address what you were talking about, doctor, but it's a part of the record. So I've learned to say, I want all discoverable documents. And so I was in a deposition the other day, and they introduced this medical note from the plaintiff's doctor. And I said, this name up here, that's the doctor's name. This is the physician assistant. So it's not the doctor offering that opinion. It's the physician assistant. And I don't know if the physician assistant is restating what this person had been seen about before, or if this is new data. So I can't answer your hypothetical in the absence of getting more information. They asked me to another challenge, another obstacle is for me to present all of my records. I said, fine, you know, obviously I have to do that. I cannot withhold that. But they'll say, you want to see the test data. I'll share with you the summary, but I won't share with you the questions. Well, why not, doctor? Well, because they're copyright. They're not mine to freely give away. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, well, where's that stated, doctor? And I said, well, turns out that I asked the test publisher in 1997, if you want a copy of that letter, I'll get it to you. But I won't disclose that without some protocols. And I'll share with them, here's how I resolved the issue, lawyer for the opposing counsel. I put the raw test data in an envelope. I right across the back, this is sealed only to be opened by the court. And I say, that's how I've dealt with it in the past, because I don't want to prevent you from seeing that data if that's something you find necessary, but it should only be disclosed to another expert who's licensed to be able to interpret those questions. And that's an obstacle, because they may take one question out of context, and then they generate hypotheticals of their own around that, which is unfair to who I evaluated. And it could be from either side. They may misunderstand that. So it's an obstacle to maintain the criteria that I have as an ethical, responsible psychologist and vocational specialist, not to disclose data that attorneys should not have in the absence of them having an expert to advise them.
I understand the distinction. How can our listeners find out more about you and be in touch with you?
Well, I have a website. It's called drmanges.com, drmanges.com. That's my website.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show and helping us tease apart some of the issues between clinical psychology, forensic psychology, your role in vocational evaluations. It sounds like you've got multiple facets of knowledge and resources that you can offer attorneys. I think that's great.
Well, thank you, Pat. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. We didn't touch at all about the workers' comp issue. We didn't touch about Social Security. We didn't touch about the criminal matters, and those are areas in which I spend a lot of time as well. But I appreciate all the work that you do for your constituency, and thank you so much for your invitation.
Well, thank you. This has been Pat Iyer and Dr. Ken Manges talking about forensic psychology, clinical psychology. Please be sure to like this show. Tell other Legal Nurse consultants about Legal Nurse Podcast and be back next week. We'll have a new show and a new interview. Thank you for joining us today.
And don't forget to purchase our inexpensive testifying training so that you become more comfortable in the courtroom. Get this training at this link, http://lnc.tips/terror. And use the code LISTENED to get a 25% discount. That link is http://lnc.tips/terror. and use the code LISTENED to get a 25% discount.
And I've got a phenomenal resource for you just waiting on LegalNurseBusiness.com. My online training and books are designed to help LNCs discover ways to strengthen their skills and their businesses. Check them out at LegalNurseBusiness.com. Many of us are lifelong learners who enjoy the chance to keep expanding our knowledge, just like the Book of the Month Clubs, my membership site, LNCEU.com, gives you 2 online trainings every month. We have a yearly payment plan that saves you over $50 compared to paying monthly, and each program is hugely discounted. Look at the options at LNCEU.com. And my last website, the LNCAcademy.com, is the coaching program I offer to a select number of LNCs. You get my personal attention and mentorship so that you can excel and build a strong foundation for your LNC practice. Get all the details at LNCAcademy.com.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on LegalNurseBusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at LNCAcademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on iTunes. We always are interested in your ideas for new topics. Please leave a comment on LegalNursePodcasts.com. Join our community and get notified of each new episode and receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on LegalNursePodcasts.com. We appreciate you and your interest.